Now, the research underlying this talk in my new book began unexpectedly with my study of poverty and charity in the Jewish community of medieval Egypt that Bert just mentioned. I discovered in that book, much to my surprise, that several enigmatic rulings about charity in Maimonides' 12th century code of Jewish law, the Mishnei Torah, over which some medieval commentators had puzzled, could be explained by drawing on evidence from the famous Cairo Geniza depicting how charity operated on the ground. The Geniza, as most of you know, is a hoard of some 330,000 manuscript fragments discovered in the latter half of the 19th century, where it was buried behind a wall in a medieval synagogue in Old Cairo. Today, the Cairo Geniza documents are spread all over the world, from Cincinnati in the west to St. Petersburg in the east, and a large collection resides here in the Jewish Theological Seminary. These Geniza tidbits include hundreds of real-time merchant letters and legal documents about commerce and commercial relations. I hypothesized, methodologically, that commercial law in Maimonides' code could be illuminated by viewing it through the lens of day-to-day commercial practice, and so I did. And in this paper, I will share with you one, albeit highly significant, example of my research results. Working with a corpus of legal material, the Talmud, that had been codified centuries earlier than in the pre-Islamic period, when commerce played a relatively minor role in Jewish life, and when few Jews, if any, engaged in long-distance commerce, Maimonides gleaned what he could from the rabbinic sources and assembled material on commercial cooperation in the section he called Laws of Agents and Partners, Hilchot Shluchim Mishutafim, part of the Book of Acquisition, Sefer HaKinyan. The juxtaposition of agency and partnership is surprising in light of the fact that the Talmud does not consider agency an aspect of commercial enterprise. Talmudic agency could take many forms, but in all cases, the agent is delegated to perform a single one-time task, like delivering a divorce document to a wife or serving as a proxy legal agent to collect a debt or a deposit. An agent receives no compensation for his services, and the Talmud holds him exculpable for non-performance of his delegated task. Furthermore, unlike a partner, he cannot be asked to take an oath attesting to his honesty. This became problematic in the post-Talmudic Islamic world when agency relations became a common feature of commercial practice because the commercial agent could not be compelled to swear an oath if suspected of mishandling his agency assignment. Maimonides treats agency and partnership together because Jewish merchants in the Geniza world employed both institutions, partnership and agency, in long-distance trade, and because these institutions possessed several similar properties. At the same time, he treated them as distinct entities because the two are in essence different. Partnership, shutafut in the Talmud, is considered a formal institution relying on a written contract between the parties, spelling out the nature and terms of their joint business venture, and requiring kinyan, the symbolic act, a kind of a handshake, confirming agreement. Typically, a partnership entailed purchase or sale of a commodity or commodities using money or goods invested jointly by the partners, all of whom shared both losses and gains. A related institution, the Talmudic Iska, is similar to a silent partnership in which one party acts as the investor and the other does the work. It is also similar to the Islamic Commenda, Kirad in Arabic, except that while the Jewish Iska holds the active partner responsible for sharing any loss, the Islamic Kirad does not. For this reason, Jewish merchants often went to a Muslim court to arrange a Kirad, which the Jews called Kirad al-Goyim, the Kirad of the Muslims. The Shluchim, in the title of Maimonides' chapter, differs fundamentally from these partnerships. Agency, wakala in Arabic, is a recognized legal institution in Islam as well. But unlike the Talmud, which conceives of agency as a one-time assignment, Islamic law envisages a wide range of agency relations that were necessary in the complex economy of the Islamic world. Yudovich describes a variation of wakala called ibda or bida'a, which he names quasi-agency. It entailed a custodianship with its own rules and expectations. A theoretical statement in Asarachsi's Compendium of Hanukkah, he died around the year 1096, regarding the actions of an agent in a commenda, may take with the investor with property, gives the following description in Yudovich's translation. And I'll read it. And the agent may entrust it to the care of another party, because doing this is part of the custom of the merchants. And the agent will have need for it in order to achieve profit. For trade is of two kinds, local in one's town and long distant in another town. And the agent cannot personally supervise both of these himself, and were he not permitted to give the capital to the care of the others, and to have the power of appointing agents, and the right to leave it as a deposit, then he would have to miss out on one of the two types because of the preoccupation with the other type. The feature of the custom of the Muslim merchants, known as ibda or bida'a, served as a model for Jewish merchants and played a crucial, indeed central role in Jewish commercial life, as well as in the adaptive response of Maimonides and there and before him of the Gaonim. Now, differing from Talmudic partnership, Shutafut, the Talmudic Iska, and the Islamic Kirad, merchant letters in the Geniza reveal a form of commercial collaboration unknown in the pre-Islamic Jewish world that was even more common than partnerships. First described by Goitein as informal cooperation or formal friendship, suhba in Arabic, and equated by Yudovich with the Islamic idda, then taken in another direction by the economist Avner Greif, and most recently treated in minute detail by Mediterranean economic historian Jessica Goldberg, in this custom of the merchants, one party entrusted goods or money to another on the basis of trust, and the recipient, acting as agent rather than partner, traded with these on the owner's behalf, without sharing in the profit, without bearing responsibility for an avoidable loss, and without receiving remuneration. The the services provided by the agent were later voluntarily reciprocated by the owner. The form of agency practiced by the Geniza merchants had a number of names, chief of them, among them, Sukhba, meaning companionship, or Sadaka, meaning friendship, or Khidma, service. On rare occasions, it's even called the Da'a, recalling the Islamic term. The agent counted on the fact that his friend, his sahib, would reciprocate similar uncompensated services. A sukhba between merchants could last a very long time, kept alive by alternating reciprocal commercial favors. And importantly, sukhba agency was normally arranged face-to-face or even by letter, not in court. Rather than a formal written contract and kinyan, it relied informally upon the reciprocal expectations and the trust that normally reassured the reliability and honesty among business friends. According to the law of the Talmud, however, as a form of agency, the institution lacked the legal enforceability that other more conventional contractual arrangements could offer. The last point brings me to the lively debate generated by the work of the economist Abner Greif of Stanford, thanks to whom the Geniza have become a household word in economists and economic historians' discourse for over 2 decades. Greif is rare among economists in combining historical evidence with conventional econometric tools. Intrigued by the sparse evidence of the Geniza of court decisions resolving merchant disputes in the Beit Din or of other Jewish judicial means of enforcing agency relations, Greif applied game theory to the Geniza evidence. His results led him to posit the existence of a closed commercial consortium, or he called it a coalition, of Jewish merchants following Goitein. Since they were from North Africa, he called them the Maghrebi merchants. These Maghrebi merchants, Greif maintained, enforced contracts through private order sanctions, relying on a multilateral reputation mechanism that prevented agents from cheating or otherwise controverting the principal's wishes. Members of the in-group reported instances of malfeasance to the rest of the consortium, bypassing legal instruments and the mediation of the Jewish courts. This system assured agents compliance with the instructions of the investor, for were they to act contrary to his instructions, they would face being blacklisted and forfeiting access to the services of all other merchants in the coalition. In Greif's view, this system arose because, as he wrote, the legal system failed to provide a framework within which agency relations could be organized. The court, he means the Jewish court, was usually unable to verify agents' claims and actions or to track down an agent who had emigrated. Even if an agent could be located, litigation was expensive and time-consuming. I shall return to Greif's claim about the failure of the legal system later on. Leutheins and Nunavut's impression that informal commercial agency was far more common than formal partnership has been confirmed statistically by Jessica Goldberg in her book, Trade and Institutions in the Medieval Mediterranean, the Geniza Merchants and Their Business World. Using sophisticated social science software to perform content analysis, she tracked twice as many, 67%, friendship arrangements as the combined total of formal partnerships, 24%, and transactions using junior associates or slave agents at 7%. She contends, however, differing in this respect from Goitein and Yudovich, that this seemingly informal practice, which she calls reciprocal agency or mutual service agency, was not quite so informal as they maintained, since it assumed an enforceable underlying, even though unwritten, agency contract that protected the rights of the principal over the property given to an agent to transact with. While the social matrix of such relationships was informal, Goldberg concedes, insofar as commercial favors were arranged with Zuchba associates without drawing up contracts, if an agent was suspected of mismanagement, the dispute could still be litigated in a Jewish or a Muslim court. Merchants could anticipate and would anticipate this possibility ex ante by making use of the Islamic law of agency as implemented by state officials and by ensuring that their agency-related activities were witnessed by other merchants should need for litigation arise in the future. Yet, despite the presence of thousands of legal documents in the Geniza, we have very little indication of how commercial agency disputes, as contrasted with conflicts concerning partnerships, were resolved in the Jewish legal system. This is the anomaly that caught Avnegrove's eye and led him to locate contract enforcement in a Maghrebi Jewish merchant consortium operating as a private order reputation mechanism. This fear of loss of reputation kept agents honest. This, in Greif's opinion, functioned as the main means of enforcing informal agency contracts where the Jewish courts did not. In fact, Zuchba agents had two other options to resolve disputes. One was arbitration, and the other was recourse to Islamic courts. The latter, of course, was frowned upon by rabbinic leaders. What was needed, therefore, was a mechanism to impose an oath on an agent suspected of mismanaging the principal's investment. Evidence suggests that two of the Gaonim, the rabbinic scholars in the Islamic period before Maimonides, recognized the problem of contract enforcement and sought a solution. But the solution proposed by Maimonides in his Mishneh Torah is the most interesting and indeed the most radical. The very first halakha in the laws of agents and partners categorically defines and codifies commercial agency, describing it in terms that perfectly fit the real life practice of Zuchba agents as reflected and depicted in the Geniza. The passage represents a substantial elaboration of the Talmudic sources identified by the commentators, most of which stem from agency in contexts other than commercial law. Maimonides writes, if one says to his agent, go out and sell a piece of land for me, or movables, or buy these for me, then the latter is empowered to buy and sell and to perform his agency mission. And notice that he uses the word shaliach, shlichut, shluchol in all of these cases, and all his actions pertaining thereto are valid. Now, lest anyone think, as many Jews doubtless did, that this form of agency required formal acts as stipulated in the Talmud for partnerships, such as writing a contract or the symbolic act of kinyan or witnessing the transaction, Maimonides goes on in this same halakha and explains. He who appoints an agent, a shaliach, does not need to ratify the appointment by a kinyan, nor does he need witnesses thereto. Oral agreement, ma'amrah, alone is sufficient. Witnesses are necessary only as evidence in case one of them makes a denial, as is the rule in all pleas. Now, given the absence of written contract in Sukhba agency and the lack of a halachic provision for judicial enforcement, Maimonides turned his attention to the Mishnaic oath of partners, Shruat HaShutafim. The Mishnaic oath of partners was used to confirm honesty and trustworthiness in a case concerning monetary matters where there was a possibility, however slight, of malfeasance or cheating by one of the parties. The underlying halakha in Mishnah Shavuot 7-8 lists five people who, as summarized by Maimonides in Agents and Partners 9-1, on the basis of rabbinic sources, must take an oath enjoined by rabbinic law, even if the claim is based only on a possibility, safek, that he stole from the other person in his business dealings or was not careful with the accounts they had between them. The five are partners, shutafim, sharecroppers, arisim, guardians, apotropim, which means people appointed by the court to care for orphans, a wife who transacts business in the house, and a person called enigmatically Ben Habayit, the son of the house. What these five have in common is explained by Maimonides with lucidity as follows. These are prone to reason that whatever they take from the property of the owner is rightfully due them inasmuch as they carry out the business and do the work. The sages have provided, therefore, that they should be required to submit to an oath, even if the claim against them is based only on a possibility, in order that they perform all their work properly and in good faith, the tzedek ve'emunah. Who, however, is the enigmatic son of the house, Ben Habayit, in the Mishnah? The Talmud explains that he is not someone who frequents the home of the householder, walks in and out, but rather someone who hires and dismisses laborers or buys and sells produce for him, what we might call a farmer's foreman. Oaths, whether prescribed by in the Torah or extended by the rabbis of the Mishnah and other cases, such as the partner's oath, were considered extremely grave because of the widely held belief that perjury which the all-seeing God would, of course, uncover, would bring divine retribution upon the individual and even upon the entire community. The Goonim stipulated that the oath of partners was to be administered with solemnity by holding a scroll of the Torah, and if the person swore that he had not acted dishonestly, his testimony was accepted. If he refused to swear, those present would draw the necessary conclusion. Now, as I mentioned earlier, the rabbis of the Talmud were reluctant to impose an oath on agents. An oath assumed a measure of mistrust that could easily deter people from assuming agency tasks. In a Geniza letter, the merchant agent Ayash bin Sadaka, writing in the middle of the 11th century, complains resentfully to his counterpart, the prominent merchant Nahrai bin Nisim, with whom he had a sukhba, about, quote, "the oath which you have had me take," unquote. With the proliferation of sukhba agency in the Geniza period, occasions for suspecting business agents of misconduct multiplied. A means was needed to assure agent compliance. Maimonides found these means by making an agent susceptible to the same exculpatory oath as a partner. He did this through an ingenious bit of hermeneutic exegesis, drawing an analogy between the son of the house of the Mishnah, as understood by the Gemara, and the commercial agent. He begins in Agents and Partners 9:4, adopting the Talmud's agrarian-based definition of son of the house, repeating its language verbatim. This person, like a true partner or a sharecropper, is required to pronounce an oath while holding a holy object if suspected of dishonesty. In the very next halakha, 9:5, Maimonides extends the oath of partners by analogy in a new direction to include a commercial agent. If a man consigns something to another on agency, the word is mishaleach, from the word shaleach, meaning agent, to sell, or if he consigns him money on agency, shalach, to buy him merchandise, schorah, or produce, even if he does not pay him for this work and he has no share in the profits or any benefit from this agency mission, shihut, inasmuch as the latter does business with the money of the other person, he is like a son of the house. Therefore, he can require him to take an oath based on an uncertain claim that he has not robbed him while bringing him the merchandise he bought for it, or part of it, or the money for which he has sold the merchandise on his behalf. Here, using analogical reasoning and inference, notice the phrase, like a son of the house, Maimonides expands the list of those subject to the partner's oath of innocence to include the commercial agent. Apart from the analogical marker like, a subtle change of language signals this move. Whereas in Halakha 9:4, as in the Talmud, Maimonides understands son of the house to be an agricultural employee who buys or sells produce, peirot. In Halakha 9:5, the one on the screen, describes him as an agent who receives money to buy for him merchandise, sakura, or produce. Moreover, the agent shaliach performs his assignment without compensation, quote, even if the owner of the property does not pay him for this work, and he, that is the agent, has no share in the profits or any benefit from this agency's mission. In short, by analogizing between the son of the house and a commercial agent, Maimonides made the latter subject to the same oath as the five Mishnaic candidates for the oath of partners. Like a partner or a sharecropper or any of the others, a shaliach, if suspected of malfeasance, inaccurate reporting of accounts, or cheating, even if the suspicion is slight, can be required by the principal to swear to his honesty. The oath must affirm Maimonides' rights that he has not robbed him while bringing him the merchandise he bought, or part of it, or the money for which he has sold the merchandise on his behalf. I submit that Maimonides' depiction of the agent in Halakha 9.5 constitutes a precise description of the unremunerated Sukhba agent of the Geniza documents, who played such a vital role in long-distance commerce in the world in which the great Jewish lived and whose legal problems he regularly met up with as a jurisconsult. Creatively employing analogy, he holds the uncompensated business agent liable to be subjected to the same oath of probity as the son of the house in the Mishnah. This use of analogy, it should be said, differs from the rabbinic technique of analogy based on the occurrence of similar lexical items in Holy Scripture, the Gezeirah Shavah of biblical hermeneutics. It lies closer to the Islamic logical method of qiyas analogy, defined as a new judicial source that responds to the need to find solutions not foreseen in the text and to define rules applicable to new situations, and a means of establishing a judicial ruling not provided for in the texts. By nesting this custom of the merchant smack in the middle of a string of Talmudic halachot dealing with partnership and similar forms of business relations, requiring an oath to establish credibility, Maimonides assimilated it to an older rabbinic concept. He in effect incorporated the custom of the Muslim and Jewish merchants into the larger Talmudic scheme, bringing the agent friend into the halachic fold. In a world in which formal and informal business arrangements existed side by side, often between the same merchants simultaneously, and in which, by consequence, the boundaries between partnership and agencies were often blurred, this made perfect sense. It constitutes, therefore, yet another case where custom in the wider society served as a core source of law. Let me just go back finally to Gleim. Gaonic and Maimonidean efforts to find a place for Sukhba agency within the framework of the halakha tend to support Avner Greif's intuitive opinion, which I quoted above, that the legal system failed to provide a framework within which agency relations could be organized. But his reasons, that the court was usually unable to verify agents' claims and actions or to track down an agent who had emigrated, and even if the agent could be located, litigation was expensive and time-consuming, overlook the more fundamental problem. Mutual reciprocal agency was simply unknown to Jews before the Islamic commercial revolution. Pre-Islamic Talmudic law had no mechanism to deal with this type of business collaboration. Jewish merchants might settle their differences out of court through arbitration. They might bring their dispute before the Jewish court if, in the absence of a written contract, they could summon witnesses to testify. They also had the option, which evidence suggests they regularly exercised, to seek resolution of wrangles over agency relations in an Islamic court. There, even with the associated court costs, commercial agency, Ibdah, the Islamic counterpart of Sufba agency, constituted a recognized form of commercial collaboration. And there, the defendant's oath was considered sufficient to establish his innocence in a dispute between non-Muslims and even between a Jew and a Muslim. These reasons, among others, it seems sufficient to explain the near total absence in the Geniza of Jewish court documents containing legal judgments, which is what led Greif, using econometrics, to propose his ingenious hypothesis and solution in the first place. If Jewish merchants relied on reputation and trust to assure agent dependability, and most certainly they did so, we should understand this as a response to the shortcoming of Talmudic commercial law that caused Jewish traders to resort to Islamic courts to resolve disagreements through arbitration, and finally, what caused Maimonides to attempt to rectify this situation by extending the work of partners to the social region. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.